Hello, and welcome to episode 41 of the Decarceration Nation podcast, a podcast about radically reimagining America's criminal justice system. I'm Josh Ho. Among other things, I'm formerly incarcerated, freelance writer, criminal justice reform advocate, and the author of the book Writing Your Own Best Story, Addiction and Living Hope. Happy New Year! I wasn't planning on starting my 2019 slate of episodes until Martin Luther King Day, which, as some of you may remember, was the date Joel and I recorded the very first episode of Decarceration Nation way back in January of 2018. I decided to do this episode now because I know a lot of incarcerated folks and their families have a lot of questions about implementation of the First Step Act, and also to address some of the early snafus, like the problem with good time credit, which turns out to have been a drafting error in the Senate version of the bill, and the pending hearings for Attorney General candidate William Barr and the implications that'll have on implementation of the First Step Act. I was very fortunate to get two incredible experts to come discuss all of this with me, Kevin Ring of Families Against Mandatory Minimum and Ames Grauert of the Brennan Center. We'll get to those interviews in just a second, but first the news. About a week ago, USA Today ran a story by a reporter named Kevin Johnson, which strongly implied that people in federal prisons should not be fed their annual special holiday meals as long as the correctional officers were not being paid because of the government shutdown. They claimed that the people in prison were being fed steak and Cornish game hens, all while the correctional officers slaved away for no pay in a dangerous job. The article was riddled with factual errors, like that the holiday meals were over well before any correctional officer missed one paycheck. As you may recall, the first time anyone missed a paycheck was last Friday. That the special meals have been around since the 80s and are budgeted for well in advance. They also don't include steak. In fact, the COE's union, who was their source, admitted later that it was roast beef and not steak, which had been served. That correctional officers can themselves eat out 365 days a year anytime they clock out, and that they have full access to the same food that folks in prison eat anytime they want it. Also that stopping people in prison from having holiday meals would have done nothing to stop the government shutdown, and letting people eat holiday meals in prison was in no way responsible for causing the shutdown. So the point of this story was a little hard to fathom aside from just demonizing and otherizing people in federal prisons. This article, and the many articles that followed, it spawned a whole bunch of articles, only quoted representatives from the Correctional Officers Union, and never tried to interview one current or formerly incarcerated person. In fact, this USA Today article might actually have printed a person in prison's mail without permission, or a quote from a prisoner's mail without permission. We've asked for clarification on this, but never received any from USA Today. Anyway, as a result of this story, me and a group of over 80 other formerly incarcerated activists came together to oppose this media narrative. Thankfully, since we started working, there have been a large number of press outlets pushing back against the USA Today and other stories that came out after. There were stories from the Washington Post, NBC News, the New York Daily News, and the Atlanta Journal and Constitution, many of whom literally published a picture of a steak served in a fancy restaurant as the header for the whole story. It was just a really gross and ugly set of stories, and I was really proud of the group of us who came together to fight back against it. And like I said, we got a lot of different press outlets to come out and support our argument, and our goals for this were kind of simple. First, we wanted to ask journalists to do better work and ensure that their stories were accurate and fair to the people in prison. Second, we wanted to ensure that journalists stop doing stories that talk about people in prison without first interviewing people in prison or people who have formerly been in prison for context. Third, we wanted to educate journalists about how to get in touch with folks in prison, how to provide resources for people who are wondering how best to do interviews with folks inside, or to just let them know that there are lots of us out here who will talk to them if they'd only ask. I will attach a link to a piece I put together that catalogs kind of the whole story and has links to all the different articles and all the different responses, etc. I also would like to bring some attention to a story that was published by my friend, Steve Bailey, who's a reporter in South Carolina this week. Steve went out of his way to make FOIA requests to obtain a report on South Carolina's prison system that was released prior to the Lee riot and then was basically swallowed up, covered up so that no one ever got to see it aside from the governor. The report proves that the South Carolina Department of Corrections either knew or should have known that they were critically understaffed at Lee and other state facilities prior to the riot. The Lee riot was the deadliest prison riot in the United States in the last 25 years, and 7 people died. In addition, many South Carolina facilities remain on complete lockdown today. Now remember, this is only a few months short of a year since the riot ended, and this isn't just the facility where the riot was. This is almost the entire South Carolina Department of Corrections. Steve was actually one of my guests last March on my episode about the Lee riot, and I just think this is an incredible job he's done, not just on this story, but on all the stories that he's done on the South Carolina Department of Corrections and the just unbelievable problems they're having there. Finally, one of my articles about the importance of passing the First Step Act was published in the Federal Sentencing Reporter in December. My article was also accompanied by incredible art by Alan Campo, who's a formerly incarcerated artist from Michigan. So I was really glad to be able to include that as well. All right, let's get to my interviews about implementation of the First Step Act. Kevin Ring is the president of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, a former Capitol Hill legislative aide, a former executive director for the Republican Study Committee, and a former lobbyist. He is the author of Scalia's Court, A Legacy of Landmark Decisions and Dissents. He is also a graduate of Syracuse University and the Columbus School of Law at Catholic University. And like me, Kevin is also formerly incarcerated. I should probably mention one other thing. Kevin is also the first person ever to be a 2-time guest on the Decarceration Nation podcast. I invited him back because his organization has been one of the organizations doing the hard work trying to answer questions from incarcerated people and their families about implementation of the First Step Act. Welcome back to the Decarceration Nation podcast, Kevin.
Thanks. What an honor. I didn't know I was the first 2-timer.
Yeah, the second 2-timer will be on right after you.
Ames always stealing my glory.
Almost immediately after passage, you were putting out messages warning people about attorneys offering to help folks take advantage of the First Step Act. Would you like to let people know what to watch for?
Yeah, this happens all the time. And you have some who are just, preying on people. They're for-profit attorneys. Some are advocates who are part-time advocates, but in their spare time, they are for-profit attorneys. In any event, they will offer people who are incarcerated and their families, to file motions for different reforms for, a couple $1,000s up to $5,000, depending on what it was with the crack retroactivity. And we wanted to make sure that people knew that they did not need to hire an attorney to do this. We wouldn't tell anybody not to if they wanted to, but that, public defenders, the federal defenders in most cases were going to handle these. And then things like good time, the good time credit expansion, they didn't need to file anything at all, that was going to be taken care of automatically by the BOP. So we always get worried. This happens every time the Sentencing Commission changes its guidelines or Congress passes a reform. You get these vultures who prey on this very vulnerable population and try to, act as if they'll expedite something which they can't do or help them achieve something they can. And people get taken for a ride. And they don't like to admit it. And so we really go out of our way to say, be warned about this because they'll be embarrassed if it happens to them and they won't share that. So we just tried to put that fire out right away.
So if you were someone who was a family with someone inside, or you were someone inside getting advice about something like this, what should they be waiting for or looking for in particular? Because you said that the federal attorneys would deal with it at some level.
Yeah, and I think what was hard was this bill, for instance, passed over, right before the holiday. And families were ready the minute after it passed to see it take effect for their loved one. And so they were calling federal defenders' offices, some of whom said, we're happy to help as soon as this becomes law. And they'd say, well, it's already been signed into law. Aren't you following this? So they were getting very anxious that the reforms weren't taking effect immediately. And so that's what happens. But now the defenders' offices are up and running. So, for instance, on the crack retroactivity, they're keeping lists, they're making lists of who's eligible. The Sentencing Commission is sending information out to the defender offices. So all of it's moving forward now. But in those early days, there was a lot of pent-up demand and anxiety. People thought they might get their loved ones home for Christmas, frankly. And so that's why there was that push.
And you mentioned crack retroactivity, so I should probably raise one of the real good stories that came out of the early implementation. Would you like to talk, since you were my guest on my episode about Matthew Charles, would you like to talk a little bit about Matthew coming home?
Sure. As you know, Matthew Charles was federal prison sentenced as a career offender. He served about 20 years, was let out mistakenly by Judge Kevin Sharp, a federal judge in Tennessee, who thought that one of the previous crack reforms applied to him. The Obama Justice Department appealed that release, and the circuit court upheld, agreed with the Justice Department. So Matthew was sent back to prison to serve another decade. And everyone, you, me, Sean Hopwood, a bunch of other advocates tried to call attention to his case. Sean, prepared a clemency petition for him because Matthew had been out for 2 years, showed he had been rehabilitated, didn't need to go back. There was no public safety benefit to him going back. As it turns out, the First Step Act gave the court an opportunity to resentence him. So his public defender was ready the day after it passed, filed a motion that said one of his charges was a crack charge that contributed to his career offender guideline. And so if the court wanted to resentence him, it had the opportunity. This time, the Justice Department said, look, we don't disagree that this is an opportunity. And if the judge now feels that she wants to give him a shorter sentence, including time served, we wouldn't even oppose that. So open the door right away. The judge signed the order, and Matthew came home. You have since seen him on NBC News and Fox News. It's just a tremendous story. And I keep saying I can't think of a more fitting beneficiary of this reform.
Yes.
His power of second chances.
Yeah, for sure. Such a great first recipient of some of the effects of the bill. Before we get to some of the implementation issues, you and your organization have been working very hard to answer questions for incarcerated folks and their families since the bill passed. I looked at your most recent frequently asked questions document. And I figured I would ask you what you think some of the most important things people should know who have someone who's in prison or someone who's in prison would want to know about the First Step Act.
Sure. I mean, we think it's important because Josh, you know this. The inmate.com rumor mill is always strong, and a lot of rumors are flying around. And we want folks inside to have hope, but we don't want them to have false hope. So getting accurate information into the facilities is really important to us and has been for 20 years. So we prepared that. Scrubbed it up and down to make sure we knew what we were talking about and that we were only answering questions we knew. The thing that people care most about is, is their loved one affected? And if so, how? A lot of questions about, we could talk about the problem with the implementation there. Confusion about the difference between good time and earn time, because people thought they were hearing about programming and this other stuff, and people who were going to be excluded from that. And they thought that meant they were going to be excluded from the good time benefits, which they're not. The crack retroactivity, obviously, people were asking questions. Some people who didn't even have crack sentences were asking if that would apply to them. So mass confusion, frankly. And what gets difficult is sometimes even families who are advocating for their loved ones really don't always know the particulars of their loved one's case. So they'll ask us, and you know, we can't give legal advice. And so that's why, going back to this issue we started with, we tell them to reach out to the federal defenders, because they need to get information that is specific to their case. It's usually legal advice, and it depends on the facts. And, you know, like I said, they don't always know the facts of their case. You really have to dig deep to figure out if something's going to apply to somebody. You really can't speculate, or you shouldn't. So the questions they really had were, you know, what was going to apply to them? How quickly would it go into effect? You know, compassionate release was something we pushed. They want to know if they can file for that immediately. The elderly offender release pilot program is back in. They want to know if they can apply for that. So really specific questions tied to their loved ones' cases, which was, you know, which makes sense, but mostly around those areas.
So way back in the bad old days, prior to passage of the First Step Act, the Bureau of Prisons was insisting on a good time credit calculation that was different than what Congress originally intended. Could you flesh this out a bit?
Sure. So the language looks like, and we all thought, that people in prison should get 54 days per year for good time, and then prorated if they, you know, served a portion of a year. The BOP had always interpreted it to give 47. We were one of the groups that litigated that to the Supreme Court and lost in a case called Barber. And in that case, the Supreme Court said 54 is really the most natural reading. And so we lost, and have ever since have been looking for a fix. What's interesting is we have been trying to get that legislatively fixed to 54 days. And those in Congress, including Senator Grassley, believe it or not, and others, opposed the expansion of good time. And the earned time credit was really seen as a way around that. They said, no, we're not going to give you any more free days off, but if you take programming and do other recidivism reducing activities, you can earn time off your sentence. So that really was supposed to be the alternative. But in the end, they changed this bill in the House to get more support and increase it to 54 days. And so now that's finally the law, and everyone is, it seems so small to people on the outside, you know, who haven't been in or who don't have loved ones. But, you know, for a 10-year sentence, an extra 70 days off your sentence, that means something to people. You know, you're talking about 2.5 months. So it was a nice thing to have there. The fact that it was so important.
So now we get to some of the complications. Given that fix that was in the bill, you know, the problem is that in the final drafting, something happened that has complicated that. Do you want to explain?
Sure. In an effort to do the right thing, they added this fix to the good time, but they put it in a section where the earned time credit is, and the earned time credit depends on folks in prison participating in this programming. And so the effective date of that whole section is, as would make sense, once the risk and needs assessment system that the Attorney General is tasked with devising is completed and released. So even though good time goes to everybody except those serving life sentences and isn't dependent on your risk, it got put into that section. And so any fair reading of the actual text of the law would seem to suggest that it too has to wait the up to 210 days that the bill gives the Attorney General to devise the risk and needs assessment. It was completely an oversight. I have no doubt that Congress intended for the good time to go into effect immediately. Every sponsor of the bill says as much. Every advocate says as much. We certainly believe that. I think all of us were looking closely to make sure, because we were fighting to get that good time provision in, that it did what we wanted it to, which was not only increase to 54, but would apply retroactively and make sure that that was explicit. So once seeing that was there, it seemed like that language was good. And people, frankly, just didn't catch the language that was further down that said, all of these amendments in this section don't apply until the risk and needs assessment is done. And so it was just a snafu. It happens sometimes with major bills. I mean, they fixed Obamacare 1,000 times, both administratively and legislatively. And that's what happened here. And so BOP immediately took the position. People will say good faith, bad faith. But again, I haven't seen an attorney read that not to mean what BOP says it means, that it had to wait. And from that point on, while families were calling Grand Prairie and trying to figure out if their loved one's going to be released in time for Christmas or New Year's, we were hearing that this is how BOP was interpreting it. And so we put notice out that, look, it may be the language of the law that needs to be fixed. And that's caused a lot of commotion. I hate to deliver that news because I know the White House is trying to fix this administratively, but it's an uphill slog because the language is so bad.
So what do you think the potential is for a legislative fix or options we have for a legislative fix in the short term? Because it becomes kind of irrelevant after 6 months or so, right?
Yeah, that's right. And, we're already, 20-something days into the bill, into the 210 days. Although, frankly, because of the shutdown, I'm not so sure the attorney general's, we have a new one coming in. Are they going to finish the risk and needs assessment in 210 days? That's another question that's going to require oversight and pressing. But in terms of the good time, the fix is easy. We've already drafted it. We've talked to champions on the Hill. We've shared it with the White House and others. The problem is, in a normal world, you would have a budget bill, some must-pass bill that would be going through right now, either a continuing resolution to keep the government funded or something to that effect. As you know, we're not in a normal world. And we have a shutdown. And so there's nothing that's must pass right now. So it doesn't matter that the White House, the Speaker, the Democratic Speaker, and the Republican Senate Majority Leader all support this or would support it. We just don't have a place to put it. So that's our problem.
But your hope is that this shutdown ends relatively quickly, and then this gets attached to the continuing resolution or whatever ends the shutdown?
Yeah, that's our hope. I mean, if the White House can't find a way around this, and look, none of this should be viewed as a criticism of the White House. The White House didn't create this problem. They didn't draft the bill. They were handed this thing that with this legislative sort of malpractice in it. They've been doing everything they can to figure a way around it. As I said, the problem is I haven't met a lawyer yet who doesn't see the interpretation problem that exists, including a judge in Illinois, who was an Obama appointee and was sympathetic to the defendant who was seeking to get out. So it's a real problem. And if the White House can't figure out a way around it, which I would understand if they can't, we do want to get it passed as soon as possible. It's ready to go. Look, that's not even a slam dunk either, because a lot of times with these budget bills, everyone has something that they want to add that they think is a must pass thing. So it's not a foregone conclusion that even if the government opens, this will be part of that bill, but we're trying to put it in as many hands and get as much support and have people realize this is a no-brainer, because our other problem is, unless it's something like the budget bill, we're going to have the same issue we had with Tom Cotton before. Whereas if it's a freestanding bill, technical fix, he'll hold it up and we'll have to waste floor time and go through that whole rigmarole again. So that, things are complicated when you're trying to pass bills.
As much as I would like a second go-around with Tom Cotton, I think I would prefer a different solution.
Yes, please. Yeah.
So there's one more pending issue in regards to, well, there's more than one, but at least one more issue with regards to implementation. This week, the Senate Judiciary confirmation hearings start for William Barr as the next Attorney General of the United States. And historically, he's not been a very big fan of criminal justice reform. But he will also, in many ways, be responsible for implementation of the First Step Act. Do you have any thoughts on this, or where are you at with the Barr hearings?
Yeah, I like to think that people can change. I changed my views on this. I had the same views probably Barr did in 1992. But my view has changed. I worry that his hasn't, because as recently as 2015, he signed a letter to the Senate sentencing reform predecessor to the First Step Act. So there's not a lot of good evidence that he's changed his view. articles came out last week saying, you know, that he's going to assure senators he'll support implementation. But, you know, and a lot of times personnel is policy. And if you have somebody who's really not committed to the same goal, and even to the same, with the same vigor, you get foot dragging. And you, you know, you've seen this over the years with the Bureau of Prisons. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he may support overall, you know, like be a good soldier and say, you know, I'll help implement this, but there's so much discretion here. There's going to be so many times where it's going to rely on the Justice Department really pushing forward with the creation of the risk and needs assessment tool. Things like, you know, we changed the 500-mile rule so people can be closer to their loved ones. Are they going to do that? Or are they going to keep saying, oh, no, there's a security risk why we can't move somebody closer? So it's going to take a lot of oversight. And this is a situation where, you know, we're probably not likely to stop him over this issue. So we're just going to have to take his word that he supports it, but then really press hard to make sure these things get implemented the way Congress intended.
I know personally, having done a lot of research and thinking about the risk assessment tool, I would want to have him on the record on a lot of questions about how that would be published and implemented. Are there particular things aside from the 500-mile rule that you want to have on the record when the, you know, when the hearing happens?
Well, yeah, a lot of things, and they're big and small. I mean, let me just mention, for instance, the elderly offender release program, which, you know, had been a pilot program in the Second Chance Act. And this gives people who are, you know, older or some terminally ill a chance to get to home confinement and get out of prison sooner. People thought, since this was an extension of that, that it would just take effect immediately. But the bill requires the AG to designate institutions where this can happen. And there's no timeline in the bill for when the AG has to designate institutions. So one, people thought it was going to apply everywhere, and you know, maybe that is, you know, how it will be interpreted, and the Attorney General will just say all BOP facilities are part of the system. Maybe not. I mean, the language doesn't require that. And so, you know, dragging your feet there would slow things down. Compassionate release. Are they going to now, families and incarcerated folks are going to be able to appeal denials, or if they don't get timely answers, go to federal court to get early release? Is the Justice Department going to go fight those motions in court? So there's a lot of discretion here, and we're going to know, you know, sometime soon how the Justice Department is going to operate here. But we know from the First Step legislative fight that there's a lot of holdovers back there, you know, who don't love this. And, you know, they were trying to gum it up in the Senate. And so I just think it's going to take vigilance.
Do you see any other possible implementation problems that we need to alert people to that we haven't discussed?
Well, I think the final thing is going to be the sentencing reforms. And the bill was pretty good about setting forth who was going to be eligible, because most of it wasn't retroactive. But there's other cases where people, you know, they might have pled guilty but haven't been convicted or haven't been sentenced. And so how those things play out is going to be important, too, to make sure that as many people benefit from the act as possible. I think that will work itself out soon, too. But, you know, again, it's all going to be in the spirit in which it's implemented. If it's going to be with the idea of getting relief and reform to as many people as possible, then the Justice Department can do that, and we're going to be fully supportive. But if they really have crabbed interpretations of these provisions, then there's going to be a fight and fewer people will benefit. And that will be, you know, a frustrating outcome. I think because there's a Democratic House now, I think oversight will be more likely. But again, on this issue, as on so many others, it's hard to get oxygen to it because, you know, there's so much about Russia and the independent counsel, and every day Trump tweets something different and everybody's running in a million directions. So we got to make sure our champions stay focused. They deserve a lot of credit for getting this bill passed. But the implementation is going to be very important, and that follow-up is going to matter.
Okay, last question. You know, we talk about the first step, so I'm sure all of us have a wish list for the second step. I know it's a little hard to get fired up right after this big battle, but do you have any thoughts on what you want in the Second Step Act?
Well, I've been reading a lot of what others have been saying, and I really sort of co-sign all of those things. I do think that, for instance, I think we need clemency reform. I think that part of the reason, I mean, I've always believed that, but the other reason I believe that is because these three of the four sentencing reforms in this bill were not retroactive. That's incredibly unfair. The people who are serving those ridiculous sentences for 924C gun stacking charges, once again, just like with the crack bill in 2010, we told those stories so that people knew there was a problem with this law. They changed the law, but they didn't fix it for those who were punished the
The ones
worst.
that were most
And so,
punished in most cases, yeah.
And so, getting relief to them, whether that's through, retroactive application of it down the road, or whether it's through a clemency process that, looks at that group as a group, and goes through those cases. I've heard people talk about conspiracy reform. I could see that. I could see an interesting mix of conspiracy and mens rea reform tied together. I also like the idea of going after some of these long sentences. Look, fixing the 841, 851 meant that, for your third offense now, you don't get life, but you still get 25 years. And in a system without, parole, there's people like Matthew Charles out there who you deserve a second look at some point during that long sentence to see if they've, used their time to rehabilitate themselves. And so I think I'm interested in looking at that type of second look provision. But I, there's a million good ideas. Pell Grant, repealing that ban is something anybody who's been talking about getting more programming in prison these last 2 years in support of First Step should support that, because access to college education, we know that's a recidivism reducer. So that's another thing that I think people should be able to get behind. So there's a million pieces, big and small. I think the key is just keep pushing. Do not rest on our laurels here. We need to implement this act, but then we need to keep pushing where we see other problems.
Couldn't agree more. Well, thanks so much for coming back on Decarceration Nation. You'll always be the first second visitor. And for
Well, thanks
sharing.
for having me.
Oh, yeah. And thanks for sharing so much important information with our listeners. Hopefully, it'll be helpful to people trying to figure out if the first step applies to them.
Well, I appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Talk to you
Okay,
later.
take care.
Ames Grauert is a senior counsel at the Brennan Center's Justice Program and the John L. New Justice Council. His work seeks to develop an understanding of the cost of America's criminal justice system to defendants, inmates, and the nation as a whole, and to translate that information into legal change. Previously, Mr. Grauert served as an assistant district attorney in the Appeals Bureau of the Nassau County District Attorney's Office. Now, the bad news. Sadly, I have to break the news to Ames that he lost out on being the first second-time guest in the history of Decarceration Nation because I interviewed Kevin Ring for the second time yesterday. So I guess that makes him now and forever the second-time guest. Hello, Ames. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks so much for having me back. It's great to be back on the show.
It's great to have you. So let's jump right in. I talked a bit about the good time credit problem with Kevin yesterday. If he and he agrees with you that it probably has to be a legislative fix, but before we get to that, can you explain why you think it has to be a legislative fix?
Yes, for sure. I hope I won't be failing to deliver the tension required for, the podcast format, because I largely agree with Kevin on most things related to this. So hopefully you're not looking for a dramatic
Well,
point
I tried to
counterpoint
leave
here.
some of the questions for you and ask him somewhat different questions, so.
Perfect. So from my perspective, why it needs a legislative fix is by a quirk of legislative drafting, everyone involved in writing the First Step Act and advocating for it was under the impression and supported the bill in part because we expected the good time fix would take effect immediately. What it looks like none of us failed or none of us reckoned with was that the good time fix provision was slotted into part of the bill that takes effect with the development of the risk and need system and not immediately. Everyone I've talked to seems to think that was a mistake. I mean, there are some people who say, their conspiracy theory that, aha, this was a secret concession to the bill's opponents. I don't think it was.
It
But
would be a
the
weird it would be a weird one because it would only last for 6 months, right?
Exactly. It'd be very, very odd. This is such an interesting problem because I think you could take this to a law school class almost and teach it as a course in statutory interpretation, because you have very clear legislative history around the bill now that everyone expected, even members of Congress expected this to take effect immediately. But on the other hand, you have the text of the bill that says it doesn't. So how do you analyze the statute? Do you look to the text, or can you try to import some of what you know that's actually not on the page of the bill itself to try to interpret it? This is a debate that goes back centuries, and it's as old as, you know, English common law. But to be candid, this is a pretty tough one, because the clear meaning of the text does seem to say that it takes effect with the risk and need system, not immediately. And, you know, as you noted, your guests, I used to be a prosecutor in the appeals bureau of a district attorney's office. And, you know, technicalities like this are the bread and butter of prosecutors. Like if I were a assistant U.S. attorney looking to figure out how I should answer a petition claiming that I was entitled to good time credit immediately, I would pull up the effective date and feel like I had a slam dunk case. There's an argument to be made, and some of our, you know, mutual friends on Twitter have made the argument that the legislator's intent should control. And, you know, I am very sympathetic to that type of legal reasoning, not just because I want the provision to take effect immediately, but because that's how I do statutory interpretation personally. I think it's a very difficult case with any court and with any prosecutor.
And we've already seen some evidence of that. There's been one decision on this already, right?
Right. Yeah. Actually, I didn't know about that until Kevin brought it to my attention. It was a federal judge. I forgot exactly where they're located. But he points out, and he's pointed this out on Twitter a couple times, that the judge who ruled that the good time fix doesn't take effect immediately, and that was the brunt of the legal ruling, is an Obama appointee. And what he means by that is there's a tendency among progressive judges to be more sympathetic to consulting legislative intent and legislative purpose as opposed to just the hard text on the page. Even the clear legislative history around this, he's suggesting, were not enough to sway this judge from what it says, you know, on the page.
And so a couple of our friends, as you mentioned, like David Safavian and Mr. Berman, and I know, for instance, Jessica Jackson Sloan has been working with the White House to try to find a non-legislative fix to this. Is the only argument that they're making the argument for legislative intent instead of statutory language, or is there any other hope for us weaseling a new way to get the actual meaning of the bill correct?
So you can go down an extremely nerdy route, and I will endeavor to do that for y'all.
Excellent.
Which is that Congress doesn't always pass particularly clear legislation. So a lot of the time it falls to agencies to interpret what Congress meant precisely. And there's a well-developed body of law around, how much leeway agencies get in interpreting statutes that affect them, from, you know, very little to quite a bit. And one of the famous rulings is called Chevron deference. It's out of a case, one of the parodies of which was Chevron, that gives agencies pretty significant latitude to interpret a statute. So technically, you could see a world where the Bureau of Prisons decided to interpret the statute to mean effective immediately based on the transcript of the law or the transcript of the legislative history and other parts about the law. Like, there's no reason in the bill for this good time fix to be tied to the risk and need system. So, you know, a BOP official could say it was clearly a drafting oversight, so I'm going to ignore it. The problem is that if BOP was so inclined to do that, they've already taken a position in court in the opposite direction, as Kevin pointed out and as you brought up in that case. And in my experience, it's not particularly easy to get an agency to reverse itself. That's one problem. Another problem is, that I think is the big problem. But the other problem is that it's not clear that this would be in natural reading of the statute. I don't know who would sue them over it, but I suspect there are agency attorneys who would be uncomfortable enough with this, even if they want to do the right thing, that it strikes me as a real uphill battle.
Well, that's unfortunate. Hopefully,
Oh, so there's one additional argument to this. It's
all right.
that, when the Good Time Law was originally passed way back in the day, you could say that the Bureau of Prisons could have interpreted it to mean the full 54 days, even without the First Step Act. So now that Congress has made itself perfectly clear what they meant by it, why can't they just interpret it the original way and not wait for the bill to come into effect? And that's another argument that I think ends in the same problem, that they've already decided not to do that, and it'd be very hard to convince them to change their minds.
It's almost like double congressional intent. We really
Yes.
meant
We really meant
it.
it. Yeah, and I would love to, being a criminal justice reform advocate, being personally a progressive, liberal, whatever adjective you choose to ascribe, all those things lead me to want to say you should be able to interpret this to be taken effect immediately. But I just think it's very, very tough territory.
So, is there any, before I get into more specific questions about the bar hearings, which start tomorrow for Attorney
Yes.
General, does the fact that the Bureau of Prisons sort of will be under new management have any impact on any of that?
Yeah, I mean it might, but I think you'd still run into a situation where a new suppose that Bill Barr was the most favorable person to criminal justice reform ever, or suppose that Trump withdraws the nomination for Barr, appoints Kevin Ring tomorrow, Kevin sails through nomination hearings and is Attorney General by Friday. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'm all for that.
All for that. Most people who would be in that position, and Kevin might be the exception to that, but would probably blanch at appearing to take a different position than their predecessor did, because it would look political. Agency staff would not like it because it looks like it's a political choice rather than something informed by the law. And you run into, having been a prosecutor, you run into a lot of inertia in organizations that are engaged in law enforcement because they love consistency. They love regular order, as Senator McCain would have said. And they don't like making breaks with their predecessors like that.
Okay, well, I'm airing this episode tomorrow, which, snow permitting, will be the first day of the William Barr hearings for Attorney General. I know that you and other folks have been writing about Mr. Barr over the last month or so. Can you fill us in on some of the potential problems you see with Mr. Barr becoming our next Attorney General?
Yes, so it's a really interesting case. I mean, Barr wrote a number of articles in the 1990s and said a number of things publicly that strike us today as, especially those of us in the criminal justice reform world, as just patently absurd. Like, he circulated a memorandum to his staff called "The Case for More Incarceration." You could say he like literally wrote the book on mass incarceration, which is not true. He circulated the book on mass incarceration, but which is a
Yeah, I've
little
read
better.
it.
Yeah, a little better. One of my colleagues, Brian, who's a fellow in the justice program here, turned up a quote where he gave an interview to USA Today, where they USA Today interviewed Barr in '94 or something. It might not have been in the early '90s, at least, on the occasion of the U.S. prison population passing 1 million for the first time in history, and Barr's reaction was, "Good, it's going to have to go a lot higher." Yikes.
Sounds a bit like our friend Tom Cotton, no?
Yeah. Exactly. It sounds a lot like some of the opponents of criminal justice reform. It sounds a lot like Jeff Sessions too. The caveat to that is that if you go back to the 1990s, and that sounds like a lot of what people were saying back then, like you could find similar quotes probably from Newt Gingrich, and Newt Gingrich now is, a very devoted advocate of criminal justice reform. You could find similar quotes from Secretary Hillary Clinton and President Bill Clinton as well. Hence the 94 crime bill. And all of them have had very public reversals of their opinions. Barr, however, did not appear to have such a change of heart. It was 2 months ago that he wrote an op-ed praising everything Jeff Sessions had done in his tenure as Attorney General. And you could hand wave that away, as you know, this is the courtesy one Attorney General extends to the other and not bashing them in public. Sure, but Barr also wrote, Barr also co-signed letters to Congress opposing sentencing reform in 2014 and 2015. And as including the 2015 letter was directly opposing the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, key provisions of which just became law as the First Step Act.
Which is a good bridge. I know in, I haven't read it yet, I just got the link earlier today, but I heard in his prepared testimony, which was released today, that Mr. Barr says that he's supportive of the First Step Act. Do you have concerns about implementation of legislation under Mr. Barr?
Yes. So I read his written testimony very briefly. So I probably fair to say I skimmed it, but he the one big thing he says in it, he says he will faithfully implement the First Step Act. But the other one is he does seem to acknowledge that there's been a huge change of heart about how the criminal justice system should work. He doesn't give specifics. He doesn't by any means say, like, I am a new convert to the criminal justice reform movement, which, you know, Donald Trump did in his remarks signing the First Step Act.
Yeah. I can't say there's a lot of times I say to his credit in relation to President Trump, but in this case, I say to his credit.
Exactly. And Barr does not say that in his written testimony. It may be that he says that in his oral testimony tomorrow. But there's a lot that Barr has control over once he becomes Attorney General, if he does become Attorney General. One of them is the First Step Act authorizes but doesn't appropriate money to be spent on the risk and needs program, on the recidivism reduction programming. It's technically up to Congress to actually appropriate that money, to actually allow it to be spent. But it's really up to the Attorney General and the Attorney General staff to advocate for that money. Congress won't just spend the money because it's there. They need someone to tell them they need it. So you need an Attorney General who, number one, believes in rehabilitation, and number two, is willing to fight for the money to do right by the people who the First Step Act is supposed to help. So that's one thing. Another is, I know a lot of our progressive allies, like the Leadership Conference and ACLU and NAACP LDF, were very concerned about the risk and needs tool that the Attorney General is supposed to develop to help award credits for participating in programming. I think you know a lot more about risk and needs tool than I do. But
this might be the only area.
I would not go. I would not say that. but having that amount of discretion over it means he has a significant amount of discretion over how the prison reform side of who's eligible and who gets credits too, I think. There's a lot that he can do. I mean, what one other thing we've seen and that I privately worry about is, you know, we've seen people start to apply for Fair Sentencing Act retroactivity. Matthew Charles applied and the DOJ didn't oppose it, and so he got his relief. The government doesn't have to enter no opposition. The government could say we oppose retroactivity or we oppose relief in this case. If an attorney general came in, and this is what I would have expected of Jeff Sessions, they could fight every one of those cases tooth and nail. And a judge may say, I don't really care, and override them. But that probably wouldn't happen in every case.
Do you feel like that Mr. Charles, that they didn't contest Mr. Charles' case might be a good sign?
Yes, in part, but I also know that was a very well publicized case where he was an extremely deserving case, and I know people were working very hard on getting Trump to hear about that case too, so it wouldn't be surprising if some word had made it to Trump, who then hinted something to DOJ that you guys better do right by him. So I'm encouraged by it, but I won't I won't pop a champagne cork yet.
Yeah, so if you had questions that you thought or hoped that the senators will get Mr. Barr on the record about, what would a few of those be?
Yeah, we actually, and I know a bunch of civil rights groups are doing this as well, we sent some proposed questions in background to senators on the Hill over the weekend, and anyone who is interested would be happy to talk to your Republican or Democrat on that. But we asked specifically if Barr had an interest in developing rehabilitative programming, or what types of programming he would want to implement, whether he would be willing to fight for the full $75 million annually for First Step implementation. We asked point blank, you know, have your views changed on mass incarceration? Are you pro? Are you anti now? I actually, and another thing that I'm curious about, it's not an issue that we work on directly, but I think it's, you probably can't end mass incarceration without rethinking marijuana penalties.
Sure.
So I wonder if Barr has Sessions' same views about marijuana. Sessions was famously almost fanatically opposed to marijuana legalization in every type.
And often would try to apply federal law even when state law had allowed it, right?
Indeed. We've done a lot of research to try to see what Barr has said about this, and he hasn't really said much. So that's an honest-to-God open question. And the good news is that, you know, when the Sessions confirmation hearing came around, we sent similar questions to the Hill and asked them to ask, you know, probing questions about his criminal justice record. And people did ask about that at the Sessions confirmation hearing, but it felt a lot like, it was, you know, pro forma, because, the Republican majority was going to confirm, Sessions, and were determined to do so. This time around, I'd be surprised if there isn't a real thorough probing of what he really thinks about criminal justice reform, because we saw, you know, the First Step Act clear by such an overwhelming majority. It would be extraordinarily frustrating if the senators, you know, Graham and Grassley, who expended so much political capital and time to see the First Step Act get passed, decide that they don't care enough to ask tough questions about implementation. Yeah, hopefully they do.
I'm definitely very hopeful that they do.
Yes.
I don't listen to all the hearings, but I think I'll be listening to this one for just that reason.
I would be shocked if it doesn't come up at length.
Yeah, I'm really hopeful. So beyond Good Time Fix and beyond Mr. Barr, do you have any other outstanding implementation concerns about the First Step Act?
So we're also, I mean, another thing to worry about the Attorney General for is we're trying to think internally about what a second step should look like.
That was going to be one of my next questions, so we can jump right to that if you'd like.
Yes. So I'll toss it back to you then.
Oh, what I think? Oh, just for the question. Yeah, I was going to say that all I was going to say was, what are some of the things you'd like to see in a potential Second Step Act? Although I know all of us are still a little bit tired from fighting for the First Step Act.
Indeed. What I was going to say about Barr and why the Attorney General matters for that is, you know, we saw how Sessions tried to sabotage every step of the way the First Step Act, sending the highly critical letters to the Judiciary Committee about the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act. There was some reporting, and I wouldn't be surprised to learn it was borne out that he was behind adding some of the odd poison pill amendments to First Step over the summer and early fall. Although I know the ones that were the subject of the final floor fight were pure cotton. but you need an attorney general who believes in this stuff to have it sail through easily. And I would want to know if Barr is the type of person who either, you know, won't say anything, or will be affirmatively helpful.
So that still leaves the question of what do you think should be in the Second Step Act?
Yes, it does. Yes. So I've seen some encouraging things, and I think this is one of our private hopes is that coming out of the First Step Act fight, you have President Trump asserting ownership over criminal justice reform. He put out through Sarah Huckabee Sanders the other day something saying like, "Of course I can't be racist. I just passed criminal justice reform," which is interesting. But I'm hoping, or what I'm hoping comes to bat for the reform movement and over the next year is the competitive primary process. You're going to see Democrats who don't want to let the president claim ownership of that, and that means they're going to have to come up with their own ideas, and they're going to have to sound bigger and more exciting than the First Step Act. And we've already seen that happen somewhat. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, before the holidays, held a press conference where she was talking about significant bail reform efforts, a bill that I'm not sure her specific bill has bipartisan support, but the issue sure does.
Sure.
I think that would be a good second step. I don't know if we've decided on what specific one we want to see. We're sort of putting together some of our policy proposals right now in the hopes of generating that competition, but between Trump and Republicans and Democratic candidates. But I don't know if we've settled on our own wish list yet. But one of them would, or one item on that list would almost certainly be bail. Another would probably be, we have an older proposal that we'd like to revisit that talks about changing the way federal grants are allocated to states, rather than having that money go to them on autopilot, tie it to metrics about building a fair justice system. So
Yeah, that was Lauren Brooks' little book that she wrote, right?
exactly the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act.
Yep.
We think there's some room for improvement on it, so we're going to revisit how we talk about it and what it should accomplish, but that's something we'd still like to see implemented
If I
too.
remember correctly, the short form is it kind of creates funding incentives to the states to base things more on successful outcomes than on, for instance, just actually housing people, et cetera. Is that more or less correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. I thought it was a really interesting idea at the time. What is there anything else that you all are thinking about or concerned about right now in terms of criminal justice reform before I let you go?
Yeah, I something that would be this is farther afield from prison and sentencing reform, but Sessions wielded the executive prosecutorial discretion ability to great effect during his tenure, and he largely shuttered police civil rights investigations. He opposed consent decrees that being entered over troubled police agencies. He directed federal prosecutors to always seek the most dangerous charge, even in lower level drug cases. I wonder if Barr continues those initiatives or changes pace a little. On the one hand, you have I bet there's some amount of decorum about it's rude to overrule your immediate predecessor when you were appointed by the same president, which I hope would not trump legitimate policy concerns about their actions. But actually, in the written testimony that Barr submitted, he alludes to concern for voting rights, which I safe to say I did not expect.
That would be interesting.
That would be very interesting. So I wonder if that signals some interest in making the Civil Rights Division back into what it was under previous presidents. I will be cautiously,
That would
I
be
won't even be cautiously optimistic.
very
I'll be skeptical.
strategically confusing from a GOP perspective, given the last couple of
It would
elections.
be. It would
But
be.
I'd certainly be happy to see it.
Yes.
Yeah, all right, man. Well, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Really appreciate you sharing your time and expertise with us. I wish Either you or Kevin had a magic answer to how we're going to get the good time credits fix done outside of legislation.
Yeah, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on, you know, what Cut of 50 is trying to do to get an executive solution. I think if anyone can achieve it, they can. So I think the like all of the above approach to getting a solution is a good one. But we'll see.
Yeah. Well, there's always hope.
Yes. Exactly.
All right. Thanks so much for doing this again.
Thank you. And I look forward to talking to you more about what comes next.
Excellent. I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to do that.
Yes, I'm sure.
All right, man. Talk to you later.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.
Now my take. I understand how frustrating this has been. I mean, I worked every day for months to help get this bill passed in hopes that day one, people would start coming home. It makes me very angry that this drafting error happened because there are men and women who should already be home but for this mistake. I can only hope that they'll keep holding on and know that we are doing everything we can from the outside to make sure that the relief comes, that the Bureau of Prisons implements the bill as intended, and that as many people as possible can be back with their families as soon as humanly possible. I hope everyone will remember that in the worst case scenario, and I know it's already really bad for anyone who could have gone home already, that what we are dealing with is delay. I'm hopeful that we can do better and that some fix will be found either as part of the end of the shutdown or by convincing the powers that be that congressional intent should matter more than an obvious legislative error. Whatever happens, lots of people are working hard to help right now. As for Mr. Barr's nomination, again, he could certainly have impacts on how this bill is implemented, but he cannot roll it back. This is now the law of the land. As Kevin Ring suggested, we have a democratically controlled House of Representatives now who will be much more willing to check executive agency power. And as Ames suggested, we have a lot of potential presidential candidates on both sides who have a vested interest in ensuring that the criminal justice ball continues to move forward over the next 2 years. Another thing that this fight has taught me is that this really is a bipartisan fight and that we have strong allies on both sides of the aisle working hard to make sure this law results in the changes that we have demanded that it makes. In particular, I think Ames is 100% right that it's very unlikely that like Charles Grassley and Dick Durbin, who expended unbelievable political capital to make this happen, aren't going to fight for it in the hearings that happen tomorrow. Well, actually today, because I'm putting this out tomorrow, but you get my point. So anyway, Ames also raised the question, what would you like to see in the Second Step Act? I agree that there's a lot of unfinished business that was left over from the First Step Act that we must deal with in the Second Step Act. I believe we must roll back the carve-outs in the First Step Act using the evidence from our experience with good time over the last several decades and evidence from the states who have implemented similar reforms to prove that there was no need for these exclusions in the first place. I believe that we must make the sentencing reforms in the First Step Act retroactive. It makes no sense to enshrine moral opposition to mandatory minimums in a piece of legislation, but then deny relief to the very people who have been most harmed by those mandatory minimums in the first place. Just like it was morally wrong to legislate a fix for the crack versus cocaine disparity, but not make it retroactive in 2010, it was wrong to not make our sentencing reforms retroactive in the 2018 First Step Act. We must make certain that 924 stacking relief is made retroactive, and we must make sure that people on a third strike all have their sentences reduced from life to 25 years. We also need, as Kevin mentioned, to go farther and deeper in sentencing reform. And we need, as Ames said, to reform bail. We should also certainly fix supervision and try to address the larger questions of policing and surveillance of impacted communities. We need to try to make sure and deal with the exclusion of formerly incarcerated folks from the public square and from the voting booth. In Colorado this year, they made it illegal to continue prison slavery. We also should make a federal case of ending prison slavery. We need to send a loud signal to the rest of the country through our federal government that slave labor of any kind is immoral and unjust. We need to work on sentencing less people to prison. As Ames mentioned, we need to start caring more about outcomes and less about incarceration. When incarceration is not the best answer, and it rarely is, let's stop incarcerating folks, period. And as long as people are incarcerated, let's make sure prison is creating opportunities and hope so that when people return, they have a path back to meaningful citizenship and to hope in the form of a job with a real future. As always, you can find the show notes or leave us a comment at decarcerationnation.com. If you want to support the podcast directly, you can do so from patreon.com/onpiratesatellite. You can also support us by leaving a 5-star review from iTunes or like us on Stitcher or Spotify. Special thanks to Andrew Stein, who does the editing and post-production for me. Additional thanks to Robert Alvarez, who redesigned the decarcerationnation.com website just this week. Thanks so much to listening to the Decarceration Nation podcast. See you next time when my guest will be Pulitzer Prize-winning author James Forman Jr.